dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as, well, an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We are obliged to spend a little time talking about one of the outcroppings of that war in a friendly country, indeed one of our closest friends, the United Kingdom, which has of late been relentlessly attacked by, well, I think of them as Sharia supremacists, a man who has stood against them courageously and for a long time, I'm very pleased to say, is our guest to discuss the latest attacks over the weekend in Britain and what is animating them and what must be done about them. He is Paul Weston. He is the co-founder of the Liberty GB, that is Great Britain Party. He is a former member of the British Freedom Party, the author in 2015 of a very important piece, Immigration, Altruism, and National Suicide. Paul Weston, it's very good to have you with us. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with us about what's going on in your country and what it portends for ours. It's good to be with you.
Thank you very much for having me on, Frank. Thank you.
Let me just ask you to start by sort of level setting for us, if you will, Paul. There have been three attacks in recent days in Britain, murderous attacks at that. What's going on, Paul? What does this rise to, as I think now, really something beyond terrorism to actually an insurgency? What's your view?
Insurgency is, I think, exactly the right word for it. And, you know, I think we've seen the some data a few years ago about what happens to countries as the Muslim demographic grows by certain percentages. And I think we're seeing now that that when it hits 5%, you start seeing proper low-level insurgency on the streets. And we've had this, three attacks, but we've also, over the last, I think, 3 months, had five more attacks, which intelligence have picked up on and stopped. And they are tracking 3,000 suspected jihadists and a further 23,000 friends of suspected jihadists. And you know, so this is something that is now taking up all of the time of the intelligence services. And the other day we had this guy called Dominic Grieve, who is in charge of our Homeland Security, effectively. He's a member of parliament. And he came out after the Manchester bombings, and he said, look, we do our best, but some of these are always going to get through, and there is nothing we can do about it. And my thought on this was, well, there is something you can do about it, but what it means is actually deporting people from this country. And he's not going to do that, so he is going to accept dead children at pop concerts and dead people on London bridges, because he doesn't want to be thought of as a racist, and actually get rid of the people that want to kill us. It's an extraordinary situation.
Well, let me come back to that in a moment, but to stay with this issue of characterizing the problem, we've, of course, been hearing a lot from Theresa May, your prime minister, who is now standing in parliamentary elections that we're told are being closely contested. I'm not sure that's right, and I think you're skeptical about that as well, but in any event, she's down to the last few days of this election as we speak, and she's struggling, it seems, to describe what her government's policy will be towards this, well, Sharia supremacism in your midst. Do you have a sense of whether there is actually any intensification of the effort on their part, or is it basically empty rhetoric at this point?
I think it's all empty rhetoric. As long as you are incapable, as she is at the moment, of naming the enemy, then there is absolutely nothing you can do about it. Because after the London Bridge terror attack the other night, she came out of number 10 Downing Street the next day, and she said it was conducted by Islamists, and Islamism is a perversion of Islam, which is a religion of peace, and it is also a perversion of the truth. Now, you know, we all know what it says in the Quran. We all know that Muhammad said, "I have been made victorious through terror." Now, we all know that, but she is banking on the fact that most people don't. She doesn't want to confront the issue, because confronting the issue means having to do something about it, and doing something about it means closing down mosques and interning suspected terrorists. And she knows that the insurgency right now would turn into potential civil war by clamping down on them. So she is just trying to soothe people and reassure people that they're on the case, but they're not. You know, they are terrified of Islam and terrified of confronting it, I'm afraid.
You have recommended your party, Liberty GB, has been pushing now for some time to address this problem by reducing the numbers of the minimum, I would assume, Sharia supremacists in the United Kingdom. We spoke yesterday with Lord Malcolm Pearson, who was very worried about the lack of help that your country is getting from non-Islamist members of the Muslim community. Would you not face, if you were to take such a draconian step as to begin removing people from Britain, that very danger of civil war? And if that's a risk, how would you mitigate it?
I'm not sure that it is something that can be avoided, because if we do nothing for another decade, we are going to see the 4 million Muslim demographic in Britain turn into an 8 million. Demographic, or possibly a 10 million. And when you start trying to do something about it, then it becomes even harder. I think we're in a very unpleasant situation where we have to do something now. It is going to cause potential unrest, potential civil war. But if we don't do it and we leave it a decade, it will become far worse to deal with. So it's between a rock and a hard place. But the sooner you deal with it, the less violence is going to occur.
I think that's the lesson of history, isn't it? That when you have hard problems, particularly those that threaten the security of your nation, generally speaking, delay, procrastination does not improve your situation by any means. Would you say that number will grow that dramatically because of just the internal demographic birth rates, or would this be compounded by further migration of people into the United Kingdom, or some combination of the two?
Well, yes, it's very much a mixture of the both. But even if you stopped immigration tomorrow completely from Muslim countries, you still have the birth rate differential. And we are declining 25% a generation as native Brits. And the Muslim demographic is 3.54 children, is doubling every decade. So it is something that has to be dealt with. And people say that surely the ones who are born here are going to be less extremist, but in actual fact, that's not the case. They are far more extremist than their grandparents were, you know, who moved here from places like Pakistan.
Paul Weston, just very quickly, Theresa May has talked about traditional British values as being more appealing than these, totalitarian values of Sharia. Is there any chance, in your judgment, that left on the same course as you're on at the moment, this will translate into relief?
Absolutely not, no, because the values that Theresa May talks about as being sort of intrinsic to us and to Britain, she says it is respect for minorities and it is tolerance. Now, you know, those are not, you know, that is not how British culture and Britain came into being. You know, these are just signs of submission, basically. And for the Muslims who look at our British values, you know, she never mentions Judeo-Christian values, none of these things. So when you have fanatical young Muslims who look at our populist MTV culture, they are quite rightly repelled by it, and they don't see any strong culture, any proper traditional English British culture, and so they're drawn even further to their own culture, which unfortunately is seeking to to actively dominate ours. So there's only ever going to be one winner in any sort of cultural value war, and that's Islam.
Paul, I thank you very much for the clarity and the courage with which you are making these kinds of points, and for sharing them with us on this side of the pond, as well as in your own country. Paul Weston, again, the co-founder of Liberty Great Britain Party. He is a remarkable ally in this war I call for the free world.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host, Kyle Scheidler. Joining us now, a good friend of Secure Freedom Radio, Diane West, nationally syndicated columnist, author of Death of the Grown-Up and The Great American Betrayal. Diana, thanks for joining us.
Oh, wonderful to be with you, Kyle.
So as you know, yesterday was the anniversary of the Normandy D-Day landing. It's a very important event in the history of World War II, a truly amazing undertaking of military power. You know, hundreds of thousands of men, hundreds of ships and airplanes, really something that had never been done before and was pulled off quite successfully thanks to the brave troops that fought in World War II. But you had an interesting piece, and this goes to something you talked about in American Betrayal, that it may have been the case that the D-Day landing didn't need to happen. So I wanted to explore that question a little bit here on Secure Freedom Radio.
I would love to. It's a very shocking thought, and for many reasons, and namely because we look at the thesis I'm putting forward, which is that the argument over the invasion of Europe was a long one that many people study when they study the history of World War II. Churchill was in favor of the southern and eastern invasion coming up the middle toward the Balkans. And you had the argument coming more from the American side and the Soviet side that northern France was the place to go. What is often forgotten, there already was an invasion of Europe that came up from Africa to Sicily to Italy. So there were actually troops fighting very hard, and the capital of Italy fell before the day before D-Day, which we kind of forget. We forget about this whole front in Italy. And one of the things I discovered when I was researching the book and really drilling down on this history was that the Allies had to withdraw materiel and men from the Italian front in order to come back and essentially reinvade Europe from the northern western part of it. And as I examined the entire discussion and the dispute, I began to wonder about the strategy here, whereby you would have the bulk of the American and English invasion very far away from the Eastern and Central European theater. And there were people at the time, diplomats, military men at the time, arguing that this would essentially remove the British and the Americans from Eastern and Central Europe and essentially leave it to the Soviets. Was this part of a Soviet strategy to essentially box the Americans and the British up, which was the case for quite some time, while they were moving into Europe and filling that vacuum? And it's a very complicated story, and there are many, many twists and turns, but I do posit that this became certainly a very important part of why it was that the Soviet Union was able to expand outside of its own borders and essentially seize half of Europe. Because the fact is, the Red Army was still inside Russian borders very late in 1943. And had the war been prosecuted more swiftly, had the, for example, anti-Nazi, anti-communist Germans been successful in destroying Hitler and his machine with Allied help that they never got, would we have seen a very different map at the end of the war? So these are some of the questions I'm looking at, and I conclude that, yes, this could very well have happened, and if that were the case, if we'd had an earlier conclusion to the war, an earlier destruction of Hitler and his machine, you would have not had an evil empire in Eastern, Central, and pushing into Western Europe. You wouldn't have had the Cold War in the same way.
I think that's an interesting question you raised, Diane, and it's especially important now as we look at U.S. and coalition forces preparing to move on the capital of Islamic State in Syria, Raqqa. And one of the big delays in that effort has been really not so much questions of how to defeat the Islamic State as to who will control what afterwards. And I think it's often the case that we sometimes forget the political element that is going on as we make military strategy. And so it's useful to take a moment and go back in time and say, you know, was it the case that this turned out the way it had to turn out? Or were there some kind of political expedience and influence and pressure being put to ensure that some side or another gets the peace at the end of the war that they seek?
Right, because the point that I did not make that's very important to look back when we consider World War II and Cold War history, is that our government, our structures, our institutional structures were literally riddled with communist agents and their accomplices. You had hundreds of agents operating in Washington who were trying to shade policy, push policy for Stalin. Stalin's interest was not simply the overthrow or destruction of Nazi Germany. He wanted to supplant it. And this is what we see in terms of the divergent strategies of the Allies, the British and the Americans, and the Soviets. And it is also a fact that the Soviet Union, even in military alliance with the British and the Americans, was always at war with them on the intelligence battlefield. And this is where you have to start looking at what those agents did. But when you actually not just identify them, but try to follow what they did. And this is what I do in American Betrayal. I try to follow, well, what if Lachlan Curry was in the White House, what did he do? Well, his portfolio was China policy for a good bit of the war. So then we can, you know, look at the Pacific War and the fall of Chiang Kai-shek being overrun eventually by Mao, very much having to do with a shift in American policy. Amazingly, our basic understanding of the narrative very often usually overlooks the intelligence angle that's always going on when you have infiltrators.
I think that's a really good point. And again, as we look at our current situation with the conflict in Syria, you can see almost daily in the Western press conflicts between various influence agents working in favor of one side or the other. Speaking of being overrun with Russian agents, I want to turn very briefly to FBI Director Comey and his testimony. And you raised an interesting point with me offline, talking about the so-called DNC hack, the situation there. And one of the points you raised I thought was really important as we look at what Comey has said and done. Can you briefly tell our listeners about that situation?
The very crux of the entire Russian hacking argument, as put forward by the so-called intelligence community, all of the various reports and so on that have been disseminated in the press that blame Russia for the hack of the DNC, that is supposed to have been this basic fact of collusion with the Trump campaign, although how that works, I still am mystified. However, that story is based not on an FBI investigation of the DNC server. It turns out that never took place. This is a straight-up lockdown fact that Comey has testified to previously. The DNC did not permit the FBI to investigate its servers. It contracted that out to a company called CrowdStrike, which, while we're on the subject of Russia, was actually co-founded by a Russian expatriate. So that all in itself is an interesting factoid, which we probably don't have time to explore right now. But the basic fact is that America's policymaking. The sanctions that Obama exacted, the diplomats expelled, this entire controversy that just continues to consume the Trump presidency, all comes down to the say-so of a DNC contractor, and Director Comey, former Director Comey, was signed with that.
Diana, that's a great point, and it's just a reminder why we spend so much time here on Secure Frame Radio talking about the role of influence and foreign influence, because it really can change the fate of nations. I think you illustrated that perfectly for us today. Diana, that's all the time we have, but thank you very, very much. And we'll be back in just a moment here on Secure Freedom Radio.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm Kyle Scheidler, guest hosting today for Frank Gaffney. Joining me now is the former Minister for Congressional Affairs at Israel's embassy in D.C. He's a consultant to Israeli and U.S. legislators and really an expert on the U.S.-Israel relationship. It's Ambassador Yoram Ettinger. Yoram, thank you for joining us here on Secure Freedom Radio.
It's my pleasure and my honor.
So we have an important anniversary that's going on right now, and it's the anniversary of the 1967 Six-Day War, where Israel fought off its Arab neighbors and really established itself as a power in the region. And this woke up, really, America to the role that Israel was able to play. Talk to me a little bit about how that occurred and what its impact was.
Well, in 1967, Egyptian military was very much involved in Yemen. About 70,000 Egyptian soldiers were stationed in Yemen. They toppled the pro-Saudi regime, and the long-term aim was to surge to Saudi Arabia from Yemen, which has always been the Achilles heel of Saudi Arabia. At that time, Egypt was a very intimate ally of the Soviet Union, and the strategic goal was to deal the U.S. a devastating blow economically and geostrategically, whereby Soviet Union and its ally Egypt would control the Straits of Hormuz, controlling the exportation of oil coming out of the Persian Gulf. At that time, the U.S. was significantly dependent upon that oil, and at the same time also controlling the Strait of Bab el-Mandeb. Following the war, a team of some 20 American military experts were dispatched to Israel, and for about 3 months, they examined the battle tactics which were exercised during the war. They left Israel with thick volumes of lessons which have had an impact on the U.S. military forces. In fact, I heard some time ago from a former commandant of the U.S. Marine Corps, General Chuck Krulak, that when he fought in Iraq, the first Gulf War, he literally followed the lessons of the Israeli battles in Sinai against Soviet tanks, implemented those lessons in his battle against Soviet tanks in the Iraqi desert. The bottom line is that the 1967 war, in my mind, transformed U.S.-Israel relations from a very clear one-way street. U.S. extends help to its ally in the Middle East to a very, very productive, mutually beneficial two-way street, which benefits both the U.S. and Israel militarily, technologically, and economically.
That's not a story we hear very much here in the United States. Why is it that so many Americans don't understand this important interplay between Israel and the United States on the strategic level? Where does the disconnect come from?
Well, first of all, most Americans, most Israelis are basically followers of the daily media. You may call it elite media, which is very simplistic in the coverage of world affairs. They don't want the readers to exercise their brain too much, and therefore provide the very fundamental level, very basic and sometimes overly simplistic level. Why cover the geostrategic, regional, global context if you can only surgically cover an event? Secondly, those among us who do pay attention to the larger context, to the real context, which is highly complex, highly complicated, do tend to share it to our own immediate associates, friends, etc. I think we haven't done enough what I would call education on a massive level, but not even massive level. I'm not sure that most people on Capitol Hill are aware of the larger context of the 1967 war and its implications for the U.S. national security until this very day.
Well, as President Trump might say, I guess we need to push back against fake news. Speaking of President Trump, I was wondering if you would briefly talk to us about the status of the Israel-U.S. relationship under the Trump administration. There are major developments right now going on in the Middle East following Trump's visit to the region. And certainly if we were going to need a strong strategic partner in the region, now would be a good time to have one. What is the status of the Israel-U.S. relationship under the Trump administration?
Well, there's no doubt that there is a robust tailwind to the geostrategic cooperation between U.S. and Israel ever since the change of the executive in Washington. However, the test is still ahead of us. Namely, we have now a president who, unlike his predecessor, realizes that the major threats emanating from the Middle East, impacting the entire world, are first and foremost Iran, the Ayatollahs of Iran, and secondly, Islamic terrorism, namely non-Shiite sources of Islamic terrorism. And there is a third challenge, which is to bolster the pro-U.S. Arab regimes. On each one of those three challenges, Israel constitutes a very unique ally, an ally which has the muscle, an ally which has the experience, which has the intelligence, mostly human intelligence, and has the capability and the will to exercise that muscle, unlike, sadly, the Europeans. There may be an obstacle to the leveraging of the potential of such natural, highly needed alliance cooperation between U.S. and Israel, and that is what I would call the classic State Department worldview, which still considers the Palestinian issue to be a core cause of regional turbulence, core cause, maybe core trigger of anti-U.S. Islamic terrorism, and a crown jewel of Arab policy makers. Obviously, reality shows that the Palestinian issue has never been a crown jewel of Arab policymakers, not the crux of the Arab-Israeli conflict. Certainly, not a core cause or cause of any of the turbulences in the Middle East. Should the U.S. be able to distance itself from that 70-year-old worldview of the Department of State, then in my mind, we would then see both the U.S. and Israel focusing on the real issues, Iran, Islamic terrorism, and bolstering the stability of the regimes in Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Bahrain, Kuwait, etc. But again, the test is still out there.
Well, I think we thank you very much, Yoram, for that enlightening tour of the geostrategic questions at work in the Middle East, and for cementing in our minds the importance of the U.S.-Israel relationship. Thank you once again, and we'll be right back here on Secure Freedom Radio.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host, Kyle Scheidler, filling in for Frank Gaffney. Joining me now on a good friend of the program, President Editor-in-Chief at the Latin American Herald Tribune, head of the International Investment Bank Caracas Capital Markets, and president of Venezuela's The Daily Journal. He's a man that we turn to when we need to know what's going on in that restive country in South America. Russ, thanks for joining us on Secure Freedom Radio.
Thanks, Kyle. Thanks for having me. It's always informative to be with you.
It's our pleasure. You're the one who informs us. So if you could give our listeners a brief rundown on the current situation in Venezuela. Obviously, things have gotten very, very difficult there. But what is the situation on the ground right now in Venezuela?
Well, Venezuela, we're moving into a new paradigm in Venezuela, in that what we're seeing now is a government that has completely screwed up the economy, brought an oil-rich country, indeed the country with the largest oil reserves in the world, to the brink of bankruptcy, and is now has its population 80% against it, the 20% being people that are on the government payroll who have to vote their own pocketbook. But the rest of the country voting their pocketbook, it wants to get rid of these bastards. And so what they're doing is changing it to a more Cuban-like system so that they can not have one man, one vote, but vote in your commune, union, or mission, or so that they can try and maintain a control with just 20% of the electorate.
This is their second attempt at jury-rigging the parliament, is it not? They had previously attempted to sort of dissolve it under the Supreme Court, and that provoked some of these protests. Is that right?
That's correct. Since the opposition won the National Assembly and quite handily and with a supermajority in December of 2015, the government has done everything it can to just ignore it. It's overruled anything that comes out of it. It's barred a couple of the assemblymen or the deputies from taking their seats so that they wouldn't have a supermajority to be able to throw the Supreme Court out, because the Supreme Court was picked in the night before the new parliament came in a kind of court packing episode to make sure that it was not so much an independent judiciary, not that it was before, but just to ensure that it wouldn't be in the future and would be more of a actually the president's personal law firm is basically what it's come to. And so finally, after ad hoc just nullifying everything that the National Assembly did, at the end of March, they decided to just kind of put that in law and just disband the National Assembly, and they would the Supreme Court would take over those powers. that pushed too far, and the population has finally rebelled against it. And so we've had over 70 days of protest ever since that judgment. To get over that, now the government is moving to just change the Constitution. They've called a constitutional assembly, not legally by referendum, but they're just going to make it happen anyway. And, of course, the Supreme Court rubber stamped it, even though there should have been a referendum to change the Constitution. But once that constitutional assembly is seated on July 30th, and they will be seated in the National Assembly, is where they're going to be. They'll disband the National Assembly, and they, under the Constitution, will then be the highest ranking body in the land.
It's interesting to me that this is obviously dramatic events in South America, but this is not something we're hearing about in the U.S. press. Why is that? Why are we not hearing about what's going on in Venezuela? And perhaps more importantly, why does it matter? Why does what happens in Venezuela matter to the average American?
Well, one of the reasons we're not hearing about it is because it's complicated and people don't understand it, and they don't understand, it's like we don't hear a lot of about the bad things that Cuba does or even Russia does except when it's Russia Week in the United States. But not even my own reporters. I had to school a reporter the other day because he turned in some standard work that made it clear that he didn't understand what was going on in the Constituent Assembly. So it kind of befuddles most people when you start talking about laws and constitutions. This body will rule in place of the National Assembly and will indeed, under the Constitution, will be the highest ranking body in the land, even higher than the president. Why should America care? Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world, and it's only a few hours from our shore. It's one of our shortest. It's the fourth largest or third largest supplier of oil to the United States. They own Citgo in the United States, which Frank and I have discussed before. We discovered it, that they had mortgaged Citgo to the Russians so that the Russian state-controlled oil company Rosneft has a 50% of Citgo as a lane. Imagine Cuba if it actually had money, because that's what you have when you have Venezuela, during the cash-rich decade that it just went through, able to spread its ideology, its communist ideology, but more importantly, an anti-American ideology with money. And even to this day, even with Venezuela as poverty-stricken as it is, with 80% of the population living in poverty, they are still able to maintain the OAS, for example, the Organization of American States, to maintain enough acolytes in the Organization of American States to stop the rest of the nations, 20 other nations, from trying to force Venezuela to mend its ways and rejoin the world of democratic nations and abide by humanitarian considerations.
I think it's tremendously important that we note how Venezuela has weaponized its financials to sort of focus almost entirely on maintaining the power of the government in terms of spending on government employees to ensure that they support the government, arming militias, paying off leadership in their neighbors so that they can avoid a censure at these international bodies. This is really the sort of foreign policy and financial policy that one expects from, you know, a Soviet-era state.
Which is where they learned it, because they learned it from Cuba. And Cuba, of course, learned it from the Soviets and gone through enough experiences that even when his foreign policies were bad before, he has been able to learn from his mistakes through longevity to be able to pass on to his ideological heirs in Havana what needs to be done.
What is current U.S. policy towards the situation in Venezuela? Does the Trump administration have a view towards this? Are they taking effective action, or is it still up in the air?
Well, he's still putting people in places, I'm sad to say. And obviously there are hotter fires all over the world. So it hasn't been on the forefront of American policy, although in this case it certainly warrants it. Most of the actions have come from the Senate and the House, who have recognized the problems that are going on there, senators like Marco Rubio and Bob Menendez of New Jersey. They have done phenomenal work in pushing sanctions. As a matter of fact, the U.S. Treasury Department sanctioned the sitting vice president of Venezuela. The second highest ranking official in Venezuela was sanctioned as a drug kingpin just 4 months ago in February by the administration. Now, that had been prepared by the Obama administration, was enacted, obviously, by the Trump administration. But that shows you what exactly we're dealing with and why these people are not going to leave through, you know, not going to go to a vote, because why have an election if you're going to lose it?
Very scary situation in America's backyard. Russ Dallin, we thank you very much for enlightening us about that situation. That wraps up your Secure Freedom Radio for today. This has been your guest host, Kyle Scheindler. Frank Gaffney will be back in the captain's chair tomorrow.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.